As damaging information continues to come out of the House impeachment inquiry, Republican lawmakers are standing by their man.
The most important thing for Republican politics right now is the approval of the president and having the president think that you are on his team.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 24th, a Republican strategist breaks down the GOP's defense of President Trump. Also on the show, an investigation into Hillary Clinton's private emails has finally wrapped up. We'll hear what lessons journalists can take from that story as we head into 2020.
You only have insight into a small window of it until the very end, and yet there's a lot of competitive pressure on journalists to deliver updates on these investigations that the public knows are going on.
Plus, Major League Baseball's domestic violence policy is under scrutiny following an offensive verbal outburst from a member of the Houston Astros front office. Lots to get to, but we'll get started with the GOP view on impeachment.
We're going to go and see if we can get inside. So let's see if we can get in.
With chants of "Let us in," a group of Republican lawmakers stormed a secure hearing room on Capitol Hill Wednesday, where a Pentagon official was set to testify as part of House impeachment proceedings.
We're going to try to go in there, and we're going to try to figure out what's going on behalf of the millions of Americans that we represent that want to see this Congress working for them and not obsessed with attacking a president.
Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida there, who led the charge. He and other lawmakers delayed the planned deposition by hours, ordering pizza and bringing cell phones into the secure room where electronics are forbidden.
This is Congressman Alex Mooney. I'm calling you live from the SCIF. We came in this morning right after the press conference around 10 a.m. We've been sitting here waiting for the hearings to start. The moment we walked in the room, Chairman Adam Schiff saw us, took the witness, and walked out of the room.
And Democrats responded to the spectacle. Here's Representative Ted Lieu from California.
You may wonder, why is it happening now? Because Bill Taylor gave a devastating opening statement yesterday. They're freaked out. They're trying to stop this investigation. They don't want to hear from witness Cooper.
After damning testimony on Tuesday by William Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, Republicans seem to move away from criticizing the content of the inquiry to taking on the process instead. And now the stunt has left a lot of people wondering where the GOP goes from here. As evidence against the president mounts, Republicans are by and large still standing by his side. Joining me now is Brendan Buck, a Republican strategist at Seven Letter in Washington, D.C. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So lots going on, to say the least, when it comes to impeachment and everything else. But I'm curious to hear your immediate thoughts on the most recent news, if you will, the Republicans who entered the sensitive compartmented information facility yesterday. What did you make of that attempt to sort of derail the House hearings?
I sort of took it for what it was on its face, which is a stunt. When you're in the minority in the House, you're relatively powerless, and that's what minorities typically do, stunts. So I don't really take it for more than that. You know, when Democrats were in the minority last Congress, they staged a protest on the House floor, stopped legislative business for a couple days. I remember during tax reform, Democrats were storming into members' offices saying, "Where's the bill?" This is what members do when they're in the minority. They don't really have any power, but they're trying to make a point. And the point is that they believe the process is broken and they're using whatever tools they have. Now, I'm not condoning going into a sensitive classified area with electronic devices, but, you know, this is a messaging exercise, and it's typical of what you see when someone's powerless like this in the minority.
So you said it's a messaging exercise. I would agree. Now, here's the interesting thing is we here on the show reached out to a number of congressional Republicans to join us today to talk about this issue. They either declined or didn't respond. So I'm wondering, why is there so much reluctance right now on the part of the GOP to really answer some questions and put themselves out there?
I mean, I think the reason they're focusing on the process or not engaging at all is because, A, on its face, the facts look terrible for the president. And B, the story keeps changing, or at least we keep learning new facts all the time. I don't think anybody is prepared to defend the substance. And so that's why you're seeing the focus on the process. Now, I will say it is not without some merit, some of the complaints about the process. It is not unusual to do closed-door interviews or depositions. It is not unusual to have certain committees take the lead and only allow committee members to go in there. It is unusual to not then share the contents of what happened with the full House. I say that because if you're going to impeach the president, it needs to be done without any question of impartiality or fairness. And there is an opening that Democrats are giving Republicans to make the argument that this is not being done in a fair, transparent manner. I understand the argument that they don't want to allow witnesses to see what each other are saying and coordinate their testimony. But at some point, they need to release the transcripts, let everyone see what is taking place in there. And it's actually, I would argue, in Democrats' best interest, because I do think that Republicans and the president are having some degree of success, at least with the Republican base, of convincing people that the fix is in, that this process is broken, and that there's something amiss here. It is at least creating a firewall with Republican voters and making sure that the president doesn't lose support ultimately where it's going to matter about his whether he stays in office, and that's with Republicans.
The Democrats say they're planning to actually, you know, eventually hold open hearings. So do you think that this stance by the Republicans is going to continue to work despite what the Democrats say they're going to do?
No, you raise a good point. I mean, it has an expiration date. You know, this is a relatively short-term play, and I don't know that anyone has articulated what the strategy is going to be when the next phase comes. I assume there will be a public phase that where they are bringing whoever has the best story to a public hearing or a few of them and talking about that. At that point, the Republicans will have to come up with a different approach. I guess my argument is that they should probably get there sooner rather than later, because the longer this hangs out there behind closed doors, the longer Republicans are able to make the argument that this is not fair and transparent, people are going to dig in. At the same time, I think there should be a level of urgency among Democrats if they want to be successful here, if only because we have a relatively short attention span in this country. And as we've already seen, we roll from crisis to crisis or outrage to outrage. And if we want to make sure that people understand all the facts, you need to bring it to the light of day. And so, we're seeing reports that they could be doing this for as long as another month behind closed doors. And I think that will give Republicans a lot of opportunities, not only on the process here, but to make the argument that Democrats are so obsessed with this and this process is dragging out so long that they're not doing the things that they said they were going to do on policy when they came to Washington.
To what extent, Brendan, is the president calling the shots in terms of the GOP strategy here? There was some speculation that the president had given his blessing yesterday to the intrusion, if you will, into the impeachment hearings. Is he really leading the charge here?
I don't know for sure. In my experience, I would be surprised if he was really dictating anything to that degree. What I can say is that he has a unique ability to put pressure on members really from the bottom up. And what I mean by that is I'm not surprised that the stunt, if you will, that took place yesterday happened shortly after the president went in front of cameras and said that Republicans need to stick together and do more to defend him. And the way that works is he says that Republican voters back home hear that. They call up their congressmen and demand to know why they aren't sticking by the president. Members come back to Washington and ask the leadership, why aren't you doing more to stick by the president? And that's where you see the events like with that stunt. The pressure that Republicans are feeling in the House is from their constituents. And it's important to appreciate that there is a large percentage of the country that still feels very strongly in support of the president. They believe he is being wronged. And the president has an ability to speak directly to them. And it creates a lot of blowback for members and puts pressure on them to take action, to be seen as defending the president.
Now, we talked about party leadership here. Obviously, Mitch McConnell is leading the charge here. But on Wednesday, McConnell denied having a conversation with the president, defending his phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. Let's take a listen to what McConnell had to say.
The president has said that you told him that his phone call with the Ukrainian president was perfect and innocent. Do you believe that the president has handled this Ukrainian situation perfectly?
We've not had any conversations on that subject.
So he was lying about that?
You'll have to ask him. I don't recall any conversations with the president about that phone call.
Brendan, what does that tell us about Mitch McConnell's relationship with the president? Is that just a fluke, or is that indicative of perhaps a larger crack in the loyalty to the president?
I'm tempted to call it a fluke, but at the same time, Mitch McConnell has never really gone out of his way to defend the president. His typical answer when asked about something the president does or says is, I have no observations to make about that. So I'm not terribly surprised that he's not out rushing to defend the president on any of this. What Mitch McConnell cares a lot about is retaining the Senate majority. This whole situation has put a few senators who are in tough reelection races in a difficult spot. Cory Gardner in Colorado, or the races in Maine and Arizona and Iowa. This is a difficult situation for some of those members. And I think what you're seeing from a lot of Republican leadership is a little level of frustration that there isn't a safe place to go. There is no single message that is resonating that seems to work. I think if I were
But Brendan, I will say this. I mean, Mitch McConnell has been a staunch advocate of the president and has also voted along what the president has wanted pretty much all the time.
Sure. I mean, they develop an agenda together, but he has not been out there in the same way that, say, a Jim Jordan in the House or a Mark Meadows in the House see getting the president's approval as a top priority and are always rushing out to defend him. I think Mitch McConnell's approach has been more to sidestep some of these issues more than step into the breach on his behalf. I think where Mitch McConnell is going to end up, if I were to predict, is that this thing is going to slip into probably the election year, and he's going to make an argument that the American people should decide whether or not the president should be removed from office, and that should be done at the ballot box. We shouldn't be impeaching a president in an election year and leave it up to the American people.
Brendan, the president has a long list of alleged crimes. The impeachment inquiry is just one of the latest examples of what the president has been accused of. And it feels as though the GOP, absent just a handful of members, no one's really calling that out. And I think when you do see a Republican criticize the president, whether it's because of his language, his policies, or any of these alleged very serious crimes, I might add, ranging from, you know, sexual assault of women to potentially colluding with the Ukrainian government here. I mean, why don't we see more folks standing up for what they believe is right and not just political?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. It's a fair question. I think that it's important to appreciate that each member is reflecting the voices of their constituents, especially in the House. Most members are in very red Republican districts, and what they're hearing from their members or from their constituents, you know, sounds a lot different than the conversation that, you know, we hear in Washington. The reality is that most members, particularly in the House, the only election that they care about is their Republican primary. There is no real safe place to go outside of supporting the president in a Republican primary these days. He really has owned the party. If you take a look at what happened when Mitt Romney decided that he was going to speak out about this, you know, the president and his whole team have been attacking him somewhat relentlessly since that happened. And I think what they're trying to do there is make an example of people. And, you know, you've seen it with Justin Amash as well, who has been a critic of the president and felt the need to even leave the party over it. And the reality is that it's going to be difficult to get reelected these days in Republican politics if you are seen as against the president. And I think a lot of members are just frankly acting in their own political interest. And at the same time, again, reflecting what they're hearing from their constituents back home. I think there was a comment from a member of Congress. It was in a BuzzFeed article not too long ago that I think really encapsulates it. A member told a reporter, you know, the president has talked about how he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and he wouldn't lose any votes. And the member said, if that happens, there better be a photograph of me stuffing a body into the back of a car, or my constituents are going to demand to know why I'm not supporting the president. The most important thing for Republican politics right now is the approval of the president and having the president think that you are on his team. There is no other place to go, really. There's no other wing of the party. The president has really taken over what other wings there were.
Well, it's a polarizing moment, to say the least. Brendan Buck is a Republican strategist at Seven Letter in Washington, D.C. Brendan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's go back for a moment to the summer of 2016, when Hillary Clinton was heavily favored to become the next president of the United States. there was one story that dominated the coverage of her campaign.
FBI Director James Comey's decision to send a letter to Congress about newly discovered emails in the Hillary Clinton investigation.
First, let me say that I am confident that I never sent nor received any information that was classified.
She said that she did not email any classified information. The FBI director says that's untrue.
Your emails are no less or no more important than the emails of anyone else.
The American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too. Me too.
After Donald Trump's election, researchers at Harvard University's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society found that media coverage of the Clinton campaign overwhelmingly focused on scandals surrounding her campaign rather than policy issues. Coverage of the Trump campaign, on the other hand, favored policy over scandals. Last week, the State Department released a report on Clinton's use of a private email server as Secretary of State. The report found 91 security violations, but ultimately determined that there was, quote, no persuasive evidence of systemic, deliberate mishandling of classified information. And this time, the news media was pretty quiet.
It very much tracks with what Jim Comey told the public back in the summer of 2016, that there was some evidence that Secretary Clinton or people at the State Department were careless, but there was no deliberate effort to mishandle classified information, and that by and large, most of these people were trying to obey the rules as often as possible, but sometimes there were some slip-ups.
That's Byron Tao, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who reported on the Clinton email story back in 2016. In light of the State Department's report, I asked Byron to reflect on the coverage of Clinton's emails in the run-up to the 2016 election.
You know, the view on the story is that what she was being investigated for, which was allegedly mishandling classified information, is something that the government takes very seriously. And we've seen others who are lower down in the government who have had similar cases find themselves in pretty significant legal jeopardy, not necessarily being prosecuted, but oftentimes being dismissed from their jobs for sort of similar fact patterns. And I think the sense at the time was that it was a fairly important story that spoke to the secretary's judgment in office and her handling of her personal affairs.
We should continue to note here that it wasn't just the Journal. I mean, the New York Times had a big role in how they reported this story so prominently. And I say that because there was a 2017 report from Harvard University's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society, and they did an analysis of 2016 election coverage. And I'm quoting them here. They say, quote, attempts by the Clinton campaign to define her campaign on competence, experience, and policy positions were drowned out by coverage of alleged improprieties associated with the Clinton Foundation and emails. Big question there. Did the scandal get more attention than it deserved? And, you know, were journalists really exposing some sort of bias, perhaps, towards Clinton as a female frontrunner?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it's important to remember that this was referred to the FBI as essentially a criminal matter. There was a criminal component to their investigation, and there was a counterintelligence component to their investigation. And at the end of the day, one of the people running for president was under investigation for questions about her handling of classified information. And the way reporters covered that was indeed aggressive, and it was indeed a front-page story in a lot of ways. But, you know, at the end of the day, this was something that the highest levels of the U.S. government were probing as a potential criminal matter. And just because ultimately they decided not to bring charges and that there was no grounds to, this was a story that journalists at the time believed that they had to cover aggressively.
New Yorker writer and CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin this week apologized for his role in covering Clinton's emails. Is there value in journalists being that reflective when they think they might have made missteps in their coverage?
You know, I think there's always value in looking back at past coverage and how stories were covered and the way that Secretary Clinton and President Trump and others were covered during those election moments are worth looking at. You know, I certainly think there are big questions raised by a lot of the coverage of Clinton, including especially at the end of the election when the hacked emails from her campaign chairman, John Podesta, started being released. You know, I think the way reporters cover stolen and hacked material is something that we haven't really hashed out. And I think that's going to be a problem moving forward as well. So there's always good reasons to critically examine past coverage, and this is no different.
I definitely want to talk about going coverage moving forward into 2020, but I do want to raise the fact that according to the Washington Post, we've seen at least several members of the Trump administration who themselves have used personal email accounts to conduct government business. Is there enough coverage on that topic, given how much coverage was given to Hillary Clinton's emails?
We have certainly seen evidence of that. We've also seen reports that the president himself is fairly careless with the way that he treats records. There was a big story in Politico about his habit of, you know, tearing up paper after he uses it, which would indeed be a violation of the record-keeping laws that apply to the president. And, you know, given the sheer number of news stories that come out of this White House every day, I do, you know, acknowledge that some of those questions about information security and the use of personal emails and the record-keeping laws have gotten buried in a lot of the other scandals swirling around this administration. So it's a perfectly valid question to ask. But at the end of the day, what Secretary Clinton was under pressure for and was really sort of being investigated for was not the fact that she used a private email server, but the fact that classified material ended up on it. And that's a very different kind of fact pattern than simply using a personal device for work purposes.
When you look at this story, Byron, and you know the fact that the State Department report found really no wrongdoing here on the part of the Clinton campaign, are there lessons that you're learning and your colleagues are learning from 2016 and how that election was covered that you think journalists, either yourself or more broadly, should really consider heading into 2020? I mean, you know, I think there are many, many that we can take away, but particular to how you cover these issues regarding presidential candidates.
Well, in terms of ongoing investigations, those are always very difficult to cover. We're seeing that right now in an impeachment inquiry where a lot of the witnesses are appearing behind closed doors, and what is coming out of that is in dribs and drabs. And that was very similar to what happened with Secretary Clinton, that, you know, we learned things not in one fell swoop, not just in James Comey's press conference in July of 2016, but in small bits and pieces over the course of a very long campaign. And that is a challenge for any major story, especially one involving an investigation, that you only have insight into a small window of it until the very end. And yet there's a lot of competitive pressure on journalists to deliver updates on these investigations that the public knows are going on. And so it's a challenge when the person under investigation is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It's a challenge when the person under investigation is the president. And it's something that journalists are going to have to grapple with.
Byron Tao is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering the Justice Department and the FBI. Byron, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's driven deep to left center field. Garner is going back. Look at him. See you later. See you later. Astros headed back to the World Series.
That was last Saturday when the Houston Astros clinched the ALCS championship. The Astros are currently down 2-0 against the Washington Nationals in the World Series, but that's not the extent of the team's troubles. They're also getting a lot of unwanted attention for an ugly incident off the field, and it centers on pitcher Roberto Osuna. As we've covered on the show last year, Osuna was traded to Houston after being suspended for 75 games after violating Major League Baseball's domestic violence policy. According to Sports Illustrated reporter Stephanie Apstein, last weekend, while celebrating their championship win at their clubhouse, Astros assistant general manager Brandon Taubman turned to three female reporters, one who was wearing a domestic violence awareness bracelet, and yelled a profanity-laced rant supporting Osuna at least a dozen times. Taubman and the Astros originally denied the report, but Taubman and team owner Jim Crane have now apologized for the comments. Trenny Kuznarek, who knows what it's like to be a woman reporting on the MLB, has been following the story. She's a host and reporter for NBC Sports Boston. Trenny, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So set the stage for us. What's the atmosphere like in a locker room after a big win? And how do women reporters generally fit into that mix?
after a team wins a game like the Astros did last Saturday, clinching a series win over the Yankees to advance to the World Series, it's bedlam. It is champagne popping, beer being sprayed everywhere. Many of us who've covered baseball for a long time actually have a kit that we call a clinch kit. Shoes, we don't care if they get soaked in champagne and beer, goggles, a raincoat to keep everything else underneath you dry because it becomes this huge party. And all of the interviews that are conducted in there are usually with loud music playing and a lot of people gathered around. So it's a pretty raucous party-like atmosphere. And rarely do we see, though, something like what happened with Brandon Taubman happen in that celebratory atmosphere.
Is it your sense that Taubman was trying to send a message to these reporters, given the fact that it was so rare? I mean, why do you think he singled out these reporters? And of course, I know you weren't there, but just based on your experience and the fact that, as you say, it's not so common.
Yeah, I think that he did it because he had a problem with one specific reporter in Houston. NPR's own David Folkenflik had a great report yesterday that he spoke with multiple witnesses who were in the clubhouse and in Major League Baseball that said that Brandon Taubman has had issues with this reporter, the one who is wearing the purple domestic violence bracelet. She had been tweeting often when Roberto Osuna was on the mound. Every time that he would get a win or get a save, she would remind people that he brutally beat his fiance and the mother of his child and was suspended 75 games, and that the Astros were the only team to look the other way and still sign him last year. So when he would have a good outing, she would tweet out something about domestic violence, where you can get help, and domestic violence hotline numbers. This apparently angered Taubman to the point where he made comments about it, had complained about her tweets to certain people, and then on Saturday directed his expletive-laden tirade at these three female reporters who were standing together in the clubhouse.
So, as you mentioned, the domestic violence incident that Osuna was a part of was very serious. He was suspended for 75 games, and yet the Astros still signed him. Why is he considered such an integral part of the Astros team? I mean, is that part of what makes Taubman continue to praise him, other than, you know, just the frustration that he has with this singular reporter?
Yes, I think so, because a closer is the last line of defense for a team winning a game. If, for instance, in that game, the Astros were clinging to a 2-run lead against the New York Yankees, Roberto Osuna, you count on him to come in and get the outs necessary to win the game. Ironically, in that game, he actually gave up a 2-run home run to DJ LeMahieu, which tied the game and forced the Astros to have to win it in the bottom of the ninth. So Osuna didn't even have a good outing the night that Taubman decided to, you know, attack these female reporters, or at least verbally attack these female reporters. But it should be noted that not all teams were willing to do this. The Los Angeles Dodgers actually at the time had a trade in place with the Toronto Blue Jays for Roberto Osuna, and the Dodgers last year, when the Astros traded for him, were also in the thick of things. They ended up winning the National League last year and losing to the Red Sox in the World Series. And when the domestic violence allegations came out and the suspension was handed down, they said, thank you, but no thank you. We do not want to take on a player who has this kind of past. So not every team did what the Astros did. There were other teams that desperately needed bullpen help, that desperately needed a closer like the Dodgers did last year, that said, it's not worth it.
I'm wondering also to that point, I mean, you know, we often hear a lot about players, particularly in the NFL, for example, who are punished for their political views, but not so much for their personal, you know, just indiscretions, whether that be domestic violence or other activities. And I'm wondering if the MLB also has players with a history of domestic violence still on the field, like Osuna.
Absolutely. You know, they have a punishment system in place, much like the NFL, where if you have a domestic violence incident, it is reviewed by Major League Baseball. They decide the appropriate punishment. You are suspended for, you know, X amount of games, but then you can return to the team. Unfortunately, these suspensions don't affect them in the postseason, which is the most important time of the year. And while obviously it can hurt your team to lose a closer and an integral part to your team for 75 games during the regular season, if you can withstand that time and withstand that schedule and make it to the postseason, it's like, you know, trading for a player right before you get to your biggest part of your season. All of the leagues, I think, have tried to address domestic violence I would say that none have fully succeeded at it. It's all very subjective. Personally, I think Major League Baseball has done a better job of handing down punishments more swiftly and more sternly than the NFL and with more consistency. But both leagues have issues. I mean, again, here's a guy, Roberto Osuna. I know people who played for the Toronto Blue Jays when this incident happened in Toronto, and they said that the clubhouse was sickened by the details, that no one wanted to be near Roberto Osuna, that they knew what a terrible person he was and what he did to his wife. And the Blue Jays, as good as he was during a rebuilding effort and someone that could maybe help their team compete in the American League East, they didn't want anything to do with him because many of the guys in that clubhouse wanted nothing to do with him. And it should be noted that when the Astros traded for Roberto Osuna, Justin Verlander, one of the best pitchers on the Astros, was not necessarily happy about it. He didn't come out and say, I wish we wouldn't have done it, but he certainly didn't have anything nice to say about acquiring a player that did something like that.
Does Taubman face any disciplinary action for his comments in the locker room?
So as of right now, he has not. Major League Baseball is investigating the incident. I'm not sure what will come of it. But based on the multiple reports and the fact that Sports Illustrated had a number of people who corroborated Stephanie's column, Jeff Passan from ESPN had others who also chimed in. And then you had David Folkenflik from NPR who went a step further and I think had four more sources on the record corroborating what happened in the clubhouse. I think it would be hard for Major League Baseball to not do something. I will say this, it has hurt Taubman. Nationally, the Red Sox actually have an open general manager position, and he was a name that had been bantered around a lot. And now the thinking is that the Red Sox won't touch this guy because who wants to bring in a guy who has this kind of past and may do the same thing in your clubhouse? And you just don't want the bad publicity and the bad media with it.
Treni Kuznarek is host and reporter for NBC Sports Boston. Treni, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. I'm back on Monday. Amy's in tomorrow, and our crew worked their tails off this week. Time for some credits. Alexandra Botti is our senior producer. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Rob Gunther, Meg Dalton, Andres O'Hara, Jason Tureski, and Jivika Varma. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our engineer and sonic scientist. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer, and David Gable is our master of calendars and our assistant. Deirdre Debke is our executive producer. Thanks to you all for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.